Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Good day, Colorado, and thank you for joining us for the March 20th reading of The Environment. This is, by the way, the first full day of spring, 2024, which means we probably are due for only 12 more inches of snow this year. Today we'll read the following main article from the magazine of the Sierra Club, Why Are Fossil Fuel Ideologues Tilting at Windmills? There's a conspiracy to take down wind and solar power hiding in plain sight. This article was written by Jason Mark. Any remaining time, we'll fill in with articles from either Mother Earth News or the Magazine of Nature Conservancy. So here we go with our first main article written by Jason Mark, Why Are Fossil Fuel Ideologues Tilting at Windmills? I have some good news and some bad news. The good news is that clean energy transition is finally shifting into high gear, spurred by the urgency of rising temperatures and stimulated by the Inflation Reduction Act, U.S. renewable energy developers are on a tear. Wind and solar are leading growth sectors for electricity generation, and in the next 2 years, utility-scale solar capacity is expected to double. Today, renewables are a larger share of the U.S. energy mix than coal and nuclear. The bad news is that the acceleration of renewables is deepening tensions within the environmental movement about how and where to build clean energy. It's been more than a decade since the construction of massive solar plants in the Mojave Desert sparked a battle between clean energy developers and conservationists, and the strains have only increased since then. At one end of the debate are land and wildlife preservationists who believe that wild places should not be sacrificed to meet the needs of a high-energy society. At the other end are self-described climate hawks who argue that the existential threat of climate chaos should trump other concerns. Such intrafamily disputes would be difficult even in the best of times and would require that people come to this important debate with grace, trust, and patience. But we don't live in the best of times. We live, rather, in an age of ugly political polarization and mistrust, amid a morass of social media misinformation and AI deepfakes. Fossil fuel ideologues know this all too well, and in recent years, they've sowed disinformation in an attempt to twist public opinion against wind and solar projects. They've taken people's good faith questions about renewable energy development and weaponized them, all in an attempt to prolong the fossil fuel era. In her investigation, Against the Wind, reporter Rebecca Burns uncovers this conspiracy hiding in plain sight. She shows how a rogues gallery of climate science deniers, right-wing think tanks, and fossil energy shills have used social media manipulation to intensify opposition to proposed wind and solar installations. In New York, notorious climate denier Mark Morano has play-acted as a Save the Whales activist to halt offshore wind. In Ohio, a former coal industry attorney was spotted organizing against a Lake Erie wind farm. For more than a decade, Burns reports, climate deniers and fossil fuel interests have quietly cultivated ties with local activists, equipping them with talking points, legal muscle, model ordinances, and other tools to try to subvert renewable energy adoption. Such tactics are little more than the same old predatory delay, now in the form of concern trolling. But above all, the disinformation campaigns against renewables are chaotic, truly tilting at windmills. The world is steadily moving towards decarbonization. The dissembling only delays the inevitable. If anything, the anti-renewable AstroTurf campaigns are a bit sad and pathetic. Climate science deniers suddenly care about the whales? Really? Still, history shows that fools can do great damage. When every tenth of a degree of avoided warming helps preserve a livable planet, every mistruth peddled against wind and solar does some amount of harm. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. The best way to guard against such mistruths is to reveal them for what they are, pure lies in the service of profit. If a former coal lobbyist is the messenger of an anti-wind screed, best to be skeptical about the message itself. If that social media image of a washed-up whale near a turbine seems too pat to be true, it probably is. So keep your head about you, and keep in mind that most of those hyped-up and overwrought arguments against renewable energy projects are often little more than an ill wind that blows nobody any good. An interesting article from the magazine of the Sierra Club, rather timely because we just passed St. Patrick's Day. Should Chicago dye its river green for St. Patrick's Day? What do you think? The dye is considered environmentally friendly, but some groups say the river should not be altered. Written by Lydia Larson. For just a few hours each year, the St. Patrick's Day celebrations on the streets of Chicago spill over into the river. A small section of the Chicago River flowing near the Michigan Avenue Bridge turns from its typical muted blue-green to a neon leprechaun green. In a city that prides itself on its Irish heritage, the tradition is well-loved by holiday revelers. This brief, altered hue is not naturally occurring, but instead stems from a dye that has seen various formulations and been the subject of environmentalist concerns over the years. The city of Chicago claims the dye it uses today now poses no ecosystem risks, but some organizations still question whether the event sets an appropriate culture of respect for the body of water running prominently through the city's downtown. The greening of the Chicago River is a tradition that goes back to 1962 and was actually born from an effort to clean up the waterway at its most polluted. According to Chicago's St. Patrick's Day Parade website, Stephen Bailey, business manager of the local plumbers union, came across a plumber whose normally white overalls were stained green. That plumber was part of a team pouring small amounts of green dye into the sewers to detect where waste was leaking into the river. It hosted only about 7 species of fish by the 1960s. Early in its history, the waterway had also been a dumping ground for the city's slaughterhouses. At times, there were so many carcasses decomposing in the Chicago River that it bubbled in places. The encounter with the overalled plumber inspired Bailey, childhood friendly of then-Mayor Richard J. Daley and chairman of this nascent St. Patrick's Day parade, to have the Chicago Journeyman Plumbers Local 130 dump this tracer dye into the Chicago River as part of the holiday celebration. The Plumbers Union still manages the dyeing today. When this event started, it was a way to, for a short period of time around a major holiday, convert something that was basically an eyesore into a decoration for Chicago's downtown, says Jack Darren, director of the Sierra Club's Illinois chapter. In the original stunt, the river stayed green for a week, while the dye used today lasts only about 4 hours. The amount and formula of the dye used in the celebration has changed over the years. Originally, the plumbers used an oil-based fluorescent dye. Environmentalists argued it was toxic to the river, and the city switched to a more environmentally friendly, plant-based dye that is orange until turning green upon contact with water. Chicago is not the only city that turns its waters green for St. Patrick's Day. Tampa, Florida, dyes the Hillsborough River for its own holiday celebration. According to Liz Hall, a communications and public relations specialist with the City of Tampa, the city uses a green-yellow tracer dye, which is typically used to track the flow of liquids, often in an attempt to protect the environment, as with the origin of the Chicago's dye. Tampa's St. Patrick's Day dye, which a company called Bright Dyes produces, meets minimum health requirements for chemicals that are added to drinking water, according to National Sanitation Foundation standards. Hall says that the Hillsborough County Environmental Protection Commission inspected the safety data sheet, and there were no objections to using it to dye the river green. To date, the city has not reported any negative effects from the event. The city of Chicago does not release the ingredients or the type of dye used in its celebration, and there is also no permit for its St. Patrick's Day event, says Darren. In the past, the Illinois chapter has recommended to the EPA that the agency require one. In a statement to Sierra, the Illinois EPA stated that while a permit has not been issued for this event, the agency did review the information and safety data for the dye and concluded that there is no toxic effect. In a 2021 letter to the editor published in the Chicago Sun-Times, the Sierra Club Illinois chapter, Friends of the Chicago River, and Openlands, a conservation nonprofit in the Chicago area, argue that even if the dye is not environmentally harmful, the city needs to rethink how it chooses to protect and interact with the river, especially as a signal to residents. The official greening event downtown has inspired road dyers in past years. In recent years, revelers have snuck green dye into the north branch of the river three times without the city's permission. Despite patrolling the area in March 2022, conservation police failed to detect the people responsible for illegally dumping green dye into a different section of the river. In the days since the original toxic formula for greening the Chicago River and the 1972 passage of the Clean Water Act, the waterway has become a source of recreation and economic activity. The plumbers' union that still dyes the river each year also claim a large part of the credit for this turnaround, says Darren. They did much of the work on the clean water infrastructure surrounding the river and continue doing work that keeps the city's water supply clean. We totally understand the origins of the practice and the fact that Chicago will always be a proud Irish town, he says. But after so much intentional work to clean up the river, dyeing it an unnatural green does seem increasingly anachronistic now that we're able to celebrate the river with its natural color most other days. Our next article is kind of long, so we'll see if we can fit it in. It's from the magazine of the Sierra Club, and it's titled, Animals Are Our Neighbors in Cities and Suburbs, Not Pests. With a little knowledge, we can learn to coexist with the coyote in the backyard or the turkey walking down the street. This article was written by Bethany Brookshire. Heather Setze never usually let her dog Lily into the yard unsupervised, but one cloudy spring afternoon in 2009, she made an exception. She darted inside to grab something from upstairs, and when she returned, her large black standard poodle was signaling to be let in. Surprised, Setze opened the screen door, and Lily walked calmly inside. As soon as she closed the door, Setze recalls, she saw something tan walk right by her house. That something tan was a coyote, living in the very center of Atlanta, Georgia. Over the next few years, Tetsi and her neighbor, Tisha Titus, realized the coyote was denning between their lots in a small, overgrown space enclosed by their back fences and a train line. They took to calling her Wiley, as in Looney Tunes' Wiley E. Coyote. She clearly lived there as much as they did. Titus would pull into her driveway to find Wiley sunning herself on the concrete. She would always stop and acknowledge my existence, but there wasn't any fear. It was just kind of like, hey, I see you up there. I smell you, she says. Wiley ate figs off their trees and shared space peacefully with the neighborhood cat, a 16-pound butterball named Ginger. As we humans alter our ecosystems, we also create opportunities for animals. Organisms that benefit from human proximity are called synthanthropes. It's easy to picture animals thriving off our trash, urban rats and pigeons or seagulls by the boardwalk. But those animals represent just one part of the anthropogenic ecosystem. The trash-eating synthanthropes often form base of a food web that feeds less obvious neighbors, such as red-tailed hawks flying over Manhattan. Other synanthropes, like suburban turkeys, thrive where human activity eliminates the predators that may cause their rural counterparts to struggle. People are happy to see some of these animals. They are a sign that perhaps we have not completely failed our wild neighbors. Many people move to suburbs or beyond to feel closer to the land, to get easy selfies with spring wildflowers, to grow or hunt their own food, or just to feel the quiet thrill of finding a fawn curled up in the forest. But when deer munch on our gardens, beavers dam up streams and flood our yards, turkeys attack, and coyotes dine on unleashed chihuahuas, suddenly nature is not so charming. In our human-centered daily lives, it's often easy to forget that nature is all around us, no matter where we live. Forgetting synanthropes are out there has consequences for them and for us. It means we react to their sudden appearance with surprise and sometimes with panic. We light up group texts and next door because we are shocked to find that the nature we live with is not actually the nature we want, and it's not behaving in the way we expect. We set out birdseed to attract orioles and finches, but get angry when squirrels show up instead. We put out poison to rid ourselves of rats and find, to our dismay, that hawks are poisoned in turn. Our suburbs and cities are not for us alone, and neither are the gardens, buildings, bridges, and trash cans that we build. They are also for our synanthropes. Acknowledging that we alter ecosystems is only the first step. The next is creating coexistence. If we want our synanthropes to succeed, the solution won't be about which animals we deliberately feed or which populations we promote or control. Instead, coexistence requires accepting our synanthropic ecosystem and understanding what aspects of our own lives benefit or harm other species. Generally, when you take a species that's uncommon and introduce it, the last thing you're really worried about is it becoming overabundant, says David Scarpitti, a wildlife biologist in the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. And yet, that's exactly what's happening with wild turkeys. When Europeans colonized the Northeast, they came with a taste for turkey legs and a love of cutting down forests. By the end of World War II, wild turkeys were almost completely gone from their natural ranges in the Midwest and eastern United States. But people still wanted to see and hunt the big, beautiful birds. Over the past 120 years, Scarpitti says, there have been various attempts to reintroduce turkeys. Success finally came with the trapping and re-release of some of the last remaining wild birds. The recovery of the turkey, says Michael Chamberlain, a wildlife ecologist at the University of Georgia, is one of the most dramatic examples of a conservation success story because turkey populations just exploded. Turkeys are thriving in urban areas and in the suburbs, parading through busy streets of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and across the campus of Harvard University. Their claws click on as much asphalt as dirt. The big birds might take shelter next to wooded running trails or in parks and feed on a mixed diet of wild food and human-provided birdseed. Turkeys prosper where houses have large enough lots to create habitat, but where people aren't always rushing back and forth in force. Yet, even as turkeys are excelling in urban areas, they are declining in wilder ecosystems. Chamberlain has documented an 18 to 20% decrease in wild turkey populations. No one knows why. It could be because of habitat loss, predators like raccoons, climate change, or a little bit of all three. There are several possibilities as to why they might be thriving in the suburbs. Bird seed and fruit from trees are as good for turkeys as they are for chickadees, Scarpitti notes. The presence of larger numbers of people keep natural predators at bay, and human hunters are not allowed in residential neighborhoods, making them safe spaces for turkeys to grow bold. That boldness, unfortunately, is making the birds less than welcome. A rafter of turkeys at NASA's Ames Research Center in California sent astrophysicists scuttling. They have attacked postal workers. One wild turkey haunted a popular trail in Washington, D.C., causing panic and even a little bloodshed. Faced with a fully fluffed out male turkey standing hip high, many respond with fear. People have been known to fend them off with sticks, umbrellas, and bicycles. Fear could be useful, though, if it's the turkeys feeling it. How could you address some of the issues with suburban turkeys, Chamberlain says. You shoot them. As long as people continue to create habitats in which wild animals thrive yet are unwelcome, the most successful animals will be those that are adept at avoiding humans. Chamberlain's research supports the efficacy of using hunting to elicit that behavioral change. In a 2023 study of collared turkeys, he and his colleagues looked at the tracks of turkeys, coyotes, and humans. They showed that after being hunted, turkeys moved away from places where people might access public land and toward private property. Hunt the suburbs, he says, and a little fear could keep turkeys and people apart. It's a technique that is deployed frequently for other overly successful suburban denizen, the white-tailed deer. Many parks, neighborhoods, and even airports now pay for yearly deer culls to reduce population numbers. Perhaps the wild turkeys upending the human-animal pecking order have gotten a little too bold. But for a city or suburban coyote, having a dash more boldness than that of its rural counterparts might be an important personality trait if the animal wants to make it among humans, says Julie Young, an animal behaviorist at Utah State University. In a 2019 study of collared coyotes in rural and urban areas, Young and her colleagues showed that rural coyotes were very shy of humans, racing away without even looking back when people tried to draw close. Suburban and urban coyotes, however, were more tolerant, particularly when there was a good cover they could hide in. The city coyotes were also more willing to explore new objects, another sign of boldness. A coyote that's too shy, she notes, will not take advantage of food and denning opportunities near humans and may not fare well. On the other hand, eating local pets or consuming food directly from human hands and nibbling at a finger in the process could get a coyote lethally removed, Young says. The middle of the bold bell curve is where the successful suburban coyotes live, just outgoing enough to den and find food among humans, but not so much that you've done something as an animal that people find unacceptable, she says. The ability to pass on these traits may be genetic, or it might simply be learned. Young hopes to do a follow-up study, switching pups from rural litters and city litters to see how their behaviors play out in new environments. The line between shy and bold is one that ensures deer, coyote, and turkeys will not be seen too often. But confronting overbold turkeys or coyotes in our suburbs and facing the choice to live and let live, to control or to cull, is ultimately a question of the kind of environment humans want to create. Can we accept that our suburbs are part of nature? Or are we content to constantly keep the animals we do not want at bay? Slinking mostly unseen through cities of millions and thriving off ecosystems that emerge through rapid human planning, not thousands of years of growth and weather, our animal neighbors show an impressive adaptability. Where people thrive, synanthropes will thrive too, whether they're hawks, coyotes, or turkeys. Coexisting with them means acknowledging that they can and do make it in our cities and suburbs, sometimes even better than in the wild. Managing them often involves a delicate balance, says Scarpetti, the wildlife biologist in Massachusetts. We do deal with people on both sides of the spectrum, people who are really frustrated with the presence of turkeys, and then there are people who are really interested in it and really find a lot of enjoyment of having turkeys on the property, he says. It's usually almost split right down the middle. Once people get beyond the shock of seeing wildlife where they don't expect it, maybe appreciation could follow. Animals are flexible, and people are too. We humans could learn to change small pieces of our lives to coexist with our non-human neighbors. If people accept that the rats that gross them out feed the hawks that they're in awe of, that coyotes live nearby but won't harm them, that they need to watch for turkeys just like they watch for bikes or cars, how differently might they behave? When Garrett started studying coyotes in Chicago, he says, I had preconceived notions about where they could live, where they could not live. He thought they'd never make it downtown, in the industrial areas, by the river. Every time I say they cannot do that, you know, after a few years, there are coyotes doing exactly that. Once we recognize the sheer adaptability of city creatures, it's not hard to be impressed. They will be our neighbors, whether we want them or not. We might as well try to get along. Three quick articles and our time is up. Thank you for joining us for the March 20th reading of The Environment. My name is John.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.